This is disc number two.
There were files in Rosner's office and files in Sophie's. Files lined the hallway, and there was a dank chamber filled with files in the cellar. And then, of course, there was all the material contained on the hard drive of Rosner's computer. So much for Shamroon's prediction that they would be back in Jerusalem by the weekend. They started in Rosner's office and worked as a threesome. Gabriel and Levon, the restorer and the archaeologist, sat side by side at Rosner's desk, while Sophie placed the files before them one by one, providing a bit of background where appropriate, translating the odd passage when necessary. Files of interest or of a sensitive nature were separated out and packed into cardboard boxes for shipment to King Saul Boulevard. By 9 o'clock, they had filled 4 boxes and found not a single reference to Ari Shamroon, Herr Rudolf Heller, or the office. Rosner, it seemed, had been a careful asset. He had also been a meticulous researcher and collector of intelligence. Contained in the rooms of the old canal house on the Groenbergwall was a remarkably detailed and frightening portrait of the radical Islamic networks operating in Amsterdam and beyond. By 10 o'clock, they were all famished. Unwilling to suspend work, they decided on takeaway. Gabriel voted for kebabs, Sophie for Indonesian, and Levon for Thai. After 10 minutes of spirited debate, they resorted to drawing a name from one of Rosner's old felt hats. Sophie did the honors.
"Thai," she said, smiling at Levon. "Shall we draw again to see who has to go pick it up?"
"I'll go," said Gabriel. "There's someone I need to have a word with."
A gentle snow was falling when Gabriel stepped outside 5 minutes later. He stood for a moment atop Rosner's iron steps, buttoning his overcoat against the cold, while scanning the street for signs of surveillance. It was deserted, except for a single bundled soul perched on a public bench on the opposite bank of the canal. He wore a threadbare woolen overcoat and a black and white checkered keffiyeh for a scarf. His gray beard was unkempt, and atop his head was the white kufi skullcap of a devout Muslim. Gabriel descended the steps and walked to the drawbridge at the end of the street. As he turned into the Stallstraat, he could hear footfalls on the cobblestones behind him. He swiveled his head deliberately and took a long, highly unprofessional look over his shoulder. The Muslim man who had been seated on the bench was now 30 yards behind and walking in the same direction. 2 minutes later, as Gabriel passed Rosner's memorial outside Café de Dolan, he looked over his shoulder a second time and saw that the man with the kufi and the keffiyeh had cut the distance between them in half. He thought of the words Levon had spoken to him earlier that afternoon at the Hotel Europa. "Just try not to kill anyone while we're in Amsterdam," Levon had said. Gabriel had no intention of killing the man. He just wanted answers to 2 simple questions. Why had a devout Muslim spent the better part of the evening sitting outside Solomon Rosner's house? And why was he now following Gabriel through the dark streets of Amsterdam? The restaurant where Sophie Vanderhaus had placed the takeaway order was in the Leidsestraat, not far from the Koningsplein. Gabriel, after crossing the Amstel, should have gone to the right. He went left instead, into a narrow pedestrian lane lined with sex shops, American fast food restaurants, and tiny Middle Eastern cafes. It was crowded in spite of the hour. Even so, Gabriel had no trouble keeping track of his pursuer in the garish neon light. The street emptied into the Rembrandtplein, but 20 yards before the busy square, Gabriel turned into a darkened shoulder-width alley that led back to the river. The man with the keffiyeh and the kufi paused at the mouth of the alley, as though reluctant to enter, then followed him in. Gabriel removed the beretta from its resting place at the small of his back and chambered around. As he did so, he could almost hear Shamroon's voice echoing in his head.
"We do not wave our guns around in public like gangsters and make idle threats. When we take out our weapons, we do so for one reason, and one reason only. We start shooting, and we keep shooting until the target is dead."
He slipped the gun into the pocket of his overcoat and walked on. At the midpoint of the alley, the darkness was nearly impenetrable. Gabriel turned into a bisecting passageway and waited there with his hand wrapped around the butt of the beretta. As the bearded man came past, Gabriel stepped from the alley and delivered a knife-like blow to his left kidney.
The man's legs buckled instantly, but before he could crumple to the ground, Gabriel seized hold of the keffiyeh and hurled him hard against a graffiti-spattered brick wall. The look in the man's eyes was one of genuine terror. Gabriel struck him again, this time in the solar plexus. As the man doubled over, Gabriel quickly searched him for weapons, but found only a billfold and a small copy of the Quran. "What do you want with me?" Gabriel asked in rapid Arabic. The man managed only a single wet cough. "Answer me," Gabriel said, "or I'll keep hitting you until you do." The man lifted his hand and pleaded with Gabriel not to strike him again. Gabriel let go of him and took a step back. The man leaned against the wall and fought for breath. "Who are you?" Gabriel asked. "And why are you following me?"
"I'm the person you're looking for in Solomon Rosner's files," he said. "And I've come to help you."
Chapter 5. Amsterdam.
"My name is Ibrahim."
"Ibrahim what?"
"Ibrahim Fawaz."
"You were a fool to follow me like that, Ibrahim Fawaz."
"Obviously."
They were walking along the darkened embankment of the Amstel River. Ibrahim had one hand pressed to his kidney, and the other wrapped around Gabriel's arm for support. A gritty snow had begun to fall, and the air was suddenly brittle with the cold. Gabriel pointed to an open cafe and suggested they talk there.
"Men like me don't have coffee in places like that, especially in the company of men like you. This is not America. This is Amsterdam."
He swiveled his head a few degrees and glanced at Gabriel out of the corner of his eye.
"You speak Arabic like a Palestinian. I suppose the rumors about Professor Rosner were true."
"What rumors?"
"That he was a pawn of the Zionists and their Jewish supporters in America? That he was an Israeli spy?"
"Who said things like that?"
"The angry boys," said Ibrahim. "And the imams, too. They're worse than the young hotheads. They come from the Middle East, from Saudi Arabia. They preach Wahhabi Islam. The imam in our mosque told us that Professor Rosner deserved to die for what he had written about Muslims and the Prophet. I warned him to go into hiding, but he refused. He was very stubborn."
Ibrahim stopped and leaned against the balustrade overlooking the sluggish black river. Gabriel looked at the Arab's right hand and saw it was missing the last two fingers.
"Are you going to be sick?" "I don't think so."
"Can you walk, Ibrahim? It's better if we walk." The Arab nodded, and they set off slowly along the riverbank.
"I suppose you were the professor's handler? That's why you and your friend are digging frantically through his files?"
"What I'm doing inside his house is no business of yours."
"Just do me a favor," the Arab said. "If you come across my name, please do me the courtesy of dropping the document in question into the nearest shredder. I respected Professor Rosner very much, but I don't want to end up like him. There are men in Amsterdam who will slit my throat if they knew I was helping him."
"How long did you work for him?"
"A long time," said Ibrahim. "But it wasn't work. We were partners, Professor Rosner and I. We shared the same beliefs. We both believed the jihadists were destroying my religion. We both knew that if they weren't stopped, they would destroy Holland too."
"Why work for Rosner? Why not the police?"
"Perhaps you can tell from my accent that I am Egyptian by birth. When one comes from Egypt, one has a natural fear of the police, secret or otherwise. I've lived in Holland for 25 years now. I am a citizen of this country, as are my wife and son. But to the Dutch police and the rest of my countrymen, I will always be an Alchtun, an alien."
"But you must have guessed Rosner was passing along some of your information to the police and the Dutch security service."
"And to the Israeli secret service as well, or so it appears."
He looked at Gabriel and managed a sage smile.
"I must confess that Israelis are not terribly popular in my home. My wife is a Palestinian. She fled to Egypt with her family in 1948 after al-Nakba and settled in Cairo. I've heard about the suffering of the Palestinian people every night at my dinner table for 35 years now. My son drank it with his mother's milk. He is Egyptian and Palestinian. A volatile mix."
"Is this the reason you followed me tonight, Ibrahim?" To engage in a debate about the Palestinian diaspora and the crimes of Israel's founders?
Perhaps another time, the Egyptian said. Forgive me, my friend. Now that you are no longer striking me, I was just trying to make polite conversation. I was a professor in Egypt before I immigrated to Holland. My wife and son accuse me of being a professor still. They've spent their lives listening to me lecture. I'm afraid they no longer tolerate me. When I get a chance to teach, I take it.
You were a teacher in Holland, too?
In Holland? He shook his head. No. In Holland, I was a tool. We decided to leave Egypt in 1982 because we thought our son would have more opportunities here in the West. I was an educated man, but my education was an Egyptian education, and so it was worthless here. I built roads until I ruined my back. Then I got a job sweeping the streets of Rotterdam. Eventually, when I could no longer even push a broom, I went to work in a furniture factory in West Amsterdam. The plant supervisor made us work 14 hours a day. Late one night, when I was falling asleep on my feet, I made a mistake with the circular saw. He lifted his ruined hand for Gabriel to see. During my recuperation, I decided to put my time to good use by learning to speak proper Dutch. When the factory manager heard what I was doing, he told me not to waste my time, because one day soon, all the Alachtunin would be going home. He was wrong, of course. A gust of wind blew pellets of snow into their faces. Gabriel turned up his coat collar. Ibrahim slipped his hand back into the pocket of his overcoat. Our children heard all the insults that were hurled at us by our Dutch hosts, too. They spoke better Dutch than we did. They were more attuned to the subtleties of Dutch culture. They saw the way the Dutch treated us, and they were humiliated. They became angry and resentful, not only at the Dutch, but at us, their parents. Our children are trapped between two worlds, not fully Arab, not quite Dutch. They inhabit the Gurba, the land of strangers, and so they seek shelter in a safe place.
Islam, said Gabriel. Ibrahim nodded his head and repeated, Islam. You still make furniture for a living, Ibrahim?
He shook his head. I retired several years ago. The Dutch state pays me a generous pension and even a bit of disability because of my two missing fingers. I manage to do a little work on the side. It's good for my self-respect. It keeps me from growing old.
Where do you work now?
3 years ago, the state gave us funding to open an Islamic community center in the Oud West section of the city. I took a part-time job there as a counselor. I helped new arrivals find their footing. I helped our people learn to speak proper Dutch, and I kept an eye on our angry young men. That's where I first heard the rumor about a plot to shoot down a Jewish airplane.
He glanced at Gabriel to see his reaction.
When I looked into the matter further, I found out it was more than just a rumor, and so I told Professor Rosner. You have me to thank for the fact that 250 Jews weren't blown to pieces over Schiphol Airport.
A pair of middle-aged homosexual men came toward them along the embankment. Ibrahim slowed his pace and lowered his gaze reflexively toward the paving stones.
I have another job as well, he said when the men were gone. I work for a friend in the Tenkata market selling pots and pans. He pays me a share of what I take in and lets me leave the stall to pray. There's a small mosque around the corner on the Jan Hassenstraat. It's called the Al-Hijra Mosque. It has a well-deserved reputation for the extremism of its imam. There are many young men at the Al-Hijra, young men whose minds are filled with images of jihad and terror, young men who speak of martyrdom and blood, young men who look to Osama bin Laden as a true Muslim. These young men believe in takfir. You know this term, takfir?
Gabriel nodded. Takfir was a concept developed by Islamists in Egypt in the 1970s, a theological sleight of hand designed to give the terrorists a sacred license to kill almost anyone they please, in order to achieve their goals of imposing Sharia and restoring the caliphate. Its primary target was other Muslims. A secular Muslim leader who did not rule by Sharia could be killed under takfir for having turned away from Islam. So could a citizen of a secular Islamic state or a Muslim residing in a Western democracy. To the Takfiri, democracy was a heresy, for it supplanted the laws of God with the laws of man. Therefore, Muslim citizens of a democracy were apostates and could be put to the sword. It was the concept of takfir that gave Osama bin Laden the right to fly airplanes into buildings or blow up embassies in Africa, even if many of his victims were Muslims. It gave the Sunni terrorists of Iraq the right to kill anyone they wanted in order to prevent democracy from taking root in Baghdad. And it gave Muslim boys born in Britain the right to blow themselves up on London subways and buses, even if some of the people they were taking to paradise with them happened to be other Muslims who wished to remain on earth a little longer.
There is a leader of these young men, Ibrahim resumed. He has not been in Amsterdam long. 18 months, maybe a bit more. He's an Egyptian. He works in an internet shop and phone center in the Oued West, but he likes to think of himself as an Islamist theoretician and a journalist. He claims to be a writer for Islamist magazines and websites.
His name?
Samir al-Masri. At least that's what he calls himself. He claims to have connections to the Mujahideen in Iraq. He tells our boys it is their sacred duty to go there and kill the infidels who have defiled Muslim lands. He lectures them about takfir and jihad. At night, they gather in his apartment and read Sayyid Qutb and Ibn Taymiyyah. They download videos from the internet and watch infidels being beheaded. They have taken trips together. A few of them went to Egypt with him. There is talk about Samir in the El Hishra. There usually is talk in the mosque, but this is different. Samir al-Masri is a dangerous man. If he is not Al-Qaeda, then he is a close relative.
Where does he live?
On the Hudsonstraat, number 37, apartment D.
Alone?
Ibrahim tugged thoughtfully at his beard and nodded his head.
You told Solomon about Samir?
Yes, many months ago.
So why follow me tonight?
Because 2 days ago, Samir and 4 other young men from the El Hisra Mosque disappeared.
Gabriel stopped walking and looked at the Egyptian.
Where did they go?
I've been asking around, but no one seems to know.
Do you have the names of the other 4 men?
The Egyptian handed Gabriel a slip of paper.
Find them, he said. Otherwise, I'm afraid buildings are going to fall.
Chapter 6. Oued West, Amsterdam.
I was really looking forward to that Thai food, said Eli Levon.
I'll get you Thai food after we break into Samir's apartment.
Please tell me where you're going to get me Thai food at 3 in the morning.
I'm very resourceful.
Gabriel rubbed a porthole in the fogged windshield and peered out toward the entrance of the Hudsonstraat.
Levon looked down and tugged at the buttons of his overcoat.
We're not supposed to use rental cars in operational situations unless they're procured from clean sources.
I know, Eli.
We're also not supposed to conduct break-ins and crash searches without proper backup or approval from King Saul Boulevard.
Yes, I've heard that.
You're bending too many rules. That's how mistakes happen. I was looking forward to spending the night at the Hotel Europa, not a Dutch holding cell.
Please tell me where I'm supposed to get a clean car and proper backup at 3 o'clock in the morning in Amsterdam.
So much for your resourcefulness.
Levon stared gloomily out the window.
Look around, Gabriel. Have you ever seen so many satellite dishes?
He shook his head slowly.
They're monuments to European naivete. The Europeans thought they could take in millions of immigrants from the poorest regions of the Muslim world and turn them into good little social democrats in a single generation. And look at the results. For the most part, the Muslims of Europe are ghettoized and seething with anger.
Trapped between two worlds, thought Gabriel. Not fully Arab, not quite Dutch, lost in the land of strangers.
This place has always been an incubator for violent ideologies, Gabriel said. Islamic extremism is just the latest virus to thrive in Europe's nurturing environment.
Levon nodded thoughtfully and blew into his hands.
You know, for a long time after I came back to Israel. I missed Vienna. I missed my coffee houses. I missed walking down my favorite streets. But I've come to realize that this continent is dying a slow death. Europe is receding quietly into history. It's old and tired, and its young are so pessimistic about the prospects of the future. They refuse to have enough children to ensure their own survival. They believe in nothing but their 35-hour work week and their August vacation.
And their anti-Semitism, said Gabriel.
That's the one thing about Vienna I never miss, Levon said. The virus of modern anti-Semitism started here in Europe, but after the war it spread to the Arab world, where it mutated and grew stronger. Now Europe and the radical Muslims are passing it back and forth, infecting one another.
He looked at Gabriel.
And so, here we are again. Two nice Jewish boys sitting on a European street corner at 3 o'clock in the morning. My God, when will it end?
It's never going to end, Eli. This is forever. Levon pondered this notion in silence for a moment.
Have you given any thought to how you're going to get into the apartment?
He asked. Gabriel reached into his coat pocket and produced a small metal tool.
I could never use one of those things,
Levon said. I have better hands than you do.
Best hands in the business. That's what Shemron always said. But I still don't know what you think you're going to find inside. If Samir and his cell are truly operational, the apartment will be sanitized.
You'd be surprised, Eli. Their masterminds are brilliant, but some of their foot soldiers aren't exactly brain surgeons. They're sloppy. They leave things laying around. They make little mistakes.
So do intelligence officers, Levon said. Have you at least considered the possibility that we're about to walk straight into a trap?
That's what Berettas are for. Gabriel opened the door before Levon could object again and climbed out of the car. They crossed the boulevard at an angle, pausing once to allow an empty streetcar to rattle past, and rounded the corner into the Hudsonstraat. It was a narrow side street lined with terraces of small tenement buildings. They were two levels in height and Orwellian in their uniformity and ugliness. At the front of each building was a small semicircular alcove with four separate doors, two leading to the apartments on the first floor, and two leading to the apartments upstairs. Gabriel stepped immediately into the alcove of number 37 and, with Levon at his back, went to work on the standard 5-pin lock on the door for apartment D. It surrendered 10 seconds later. He slipped the lockpick into his pocket and removed the Beretta, then turned the latch and stepped inside. He stood motionless for a moment in the darkness, gun leveled in his outstretched hands, listening for the faintest sound or slightest suggestion of movement. Hearing nothing, he motioned for Levon to come inside. Levon switched on a small maglight and led the way into the sitting room. The furnishings were of flea market quality, the floor was cracked linoleum, and the walls were bare, except for a single travel poster depicting the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem. Gabriel walked over to the long trestle table that served as Samir's desk. It was empty except for a single yellow legal pad and a cheap desk lamp. He switched on the lamp and examined the pad. Two-thirds of it had been used, and the top page was blank. He moved his fingers over the surface and felt impressions. An amateur's mistake. He handed the pad to Levon, then took hold of the flashlight and shone it at an angle over the surface of the table. It was covered in a fine layer of dust, except for a precise square in the center, the spot, Gabriel reckoned, where Samir's computer had been before his flight from Amsterdam.
Search the furniture cushions, Gabriel said. I'll have a look around the rest of the flat.
He went through a doorway into the kitchen. The debris of Samir's final gathering with his acolytes from the Al-Hijra Mosque lay strewn across the linoleum countertops, empty takeaway containers, greasy paper plates, discarded plastic utensils, squashed tea bags. Gabriel opened the refrigerator, a favorite terrorist storage space for explosives, and saw that it was empty. The same was true of all the cabinets. He looked in the cupboard beneath the sink and found nothing but an unopened container of kitchen cleaner. Samir, Islamic theoretician and spokesman for the jihadi cause, was a typical bachelor slob. Gabriel paused for a moment in the sitting room to check on Levon's progress, then headed down a short hallway toward the back of the apartment. Samir's bathroom was as appalling as the kitchen.
Gabriel gave it a rapid search, then entered the bedroom. A stripped mattress lay slightly askew on the metal frame, and the three drawers of the dresser were all partially open. Samir, it seemed, had packed in a hurry. Gabriel removed the top drawer and dumped the remaining contents onto the bed. Threadbare underwear, mismatched socks, a book of matches from a discotheque in London's Leicester Square, an envelope from a photo processing shop around the corner. Gabriel slipped the matches into his pocket, then opened the envelope and leafed through the prints. He saw Samir in Trafalgar Square, and Samir with a member of the Queen's Life Guard outside Buckingham Palace, Samir riding the Millennium Wheel, and Samir outside the Houses of Parliament. The last photograph, Samir posing with four friends in front of the American Embassy in Grosvenor Square, caused Gabriel's heart to skip a beat. 5 minutes later, he was walking calmly along the empty pavements of the Hudsonstraat, with the photographs in his pocket and Levon at his side.
If the dates on the pictures are correct, it means Samir and his friends were in London 4 months ago, he said. Someone should probably go to London to have a word with our friends at MI5.
I can see where this is heading, Levon said. You get to go ride into London like a knight on a white horse, and I get to go blind reading the rest of Solomon Rosner's files.
At least you get to have your Thai food.
Why did you have to mention the Thai food?
Chapter 7. Heathrow Airport, London. Gabriel had spent much of his life eluding the police forces and security services of Europe, and so it was with considerable reluctance that he agreed to be met at Heathrow Airport the following afternoon by MI5. He spotted the three-man reception team as he came into the arrivals hall. It was not difficult. They were wearing matching Macintosh raincoats, and one was holding Gabriel's photograph. He had been instructed to let the MI5 men make the approach, so he went to the information kiosk and spent several minutes pretending to scrutinize a list of London hotels. Finally, anxious to deliver his briefing before the terrorists struck, he walked over and introduced himself. The officer with the photograph took him by the arm and led him outside to a waiting Jaguar limousine. Gabriel smiled. He had always harbored a secret envy of British spies and their cars. The rear window slid down a few inches and a long, bony hand beckoned him over. The hand was attached to none other than Graham Seymour, MI5's long-serving and highly regarded Deputy Director General. He was in his late 50s now, and had aged like fine wine. His Savile Row pinstriped suit fit him to perfection, and his full head of blonde hair had a silvery cast to it that gave him the look of those male models one sees in advertisements for costly but needless trinkets. As Gabriel climbed into the car, Seymour appraised him silently for a moment with a pair of granite-colored eyes. He did not look pleased, but then few men in his position would. The Netherlands, France, Germany, and Spain all had their fair share of Muslim radicals, but among intelligence professionals, there was little disagreement over which country was the epicenter of European Islamic extremism. It was the country Graham Seymour was sworn to protect, the United Kingdom. Gabriel knew that the crisis now facing Britain was many years in the making and, to a large degree, self-inflicted. For 2 decades, beginning in the 1980s and continuing even after the attacks of 9/11, British governments, both Labour and Tory, had thrown open their doors to the world's most hardened holy warriors, cast out by countries such as Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Syria. They had come to London, where they were free to publish, preach, organize, conspire, and raise money. As a result, Great Britain, the land of John Locke, William Shakespeare, and Winston Churchill, had unwittingly allowed itself to become the primary incubator of a violent ideology that sought to destroy everything for which it had once stood. The British security and intelligence services, confronted by a gathering storm, had responded by choosing the path of accommodation rather than resistance. Extremism was tolerated so long as it was directed outward, toward the secular Arab regimes, America, and, of course, Israel. The failure of this policy of appeasement had been held up for all the world to see on July 7, 2005, when 3 bombs exploded inside the London Underground and a 4th tore a London city bus to shreds in Russell Square. 52 people were killed and 700 more wounded. The perpetrators of this bloodbath were not destitute Muslims from abroad, but middle-class British boys who had turned on the country of their birth,
and all evidence suggested it was only their opening salvo. Her Majesty's Security Services estimated the number of terrorists residing in Britain at 16,000, 3,000 of whom had actually trained in Al-Qaeda camps, and recent intelligence suggested that the United Kingdom had eclipsed America and Israel as Al-Qaeda's primary target.
"It's funny," said Seymour, "but when we checked the manifest for the flight from Amsterdam, we didn't see anyone on the list named Gabriel Allon."
"Obviously you didn't look hard enough."
The MI5 man held out his hand.
"Let's not do this, Graham. Haven't we more pressing matters to deal with than the name on my passport? Give it to me."
Gabriel surrendered his passport and stared out the window at the traffic rushing along the A4. It was 3:30 in the afternoon, and already dark. No wonder the Arabs turned to radicals when they moved here, he thought. Perhaps it was light deprivation that drove them to jihad and terror. Graham Seymour opened the passport and recited the particulars.
"Heinrich Kiewer, place of birth, Berlin."
He looked up at Gabriel.
"East or west?"
"Herr Kiewer is definitely a man of the west."
"We had an agreement, Alon."
"Yes, I know."
"It stated that we would grant you absolution for your multitude of sins in exchange for a simple commitment on your part, that you would inform us when you were coming to our fair shores, and that you would refrain from conducting operations on our soil without obtaining our permission and cooperation beforehand."
"I'm sitting in the back of an MI5 limousine. How much more cooperation and notification do you require?"
"What about the passport?"
"It's nice, isn't it?"
"Do the Germans know you're abusing their travel documents?"
"We abuse yours too, Graham.
It's what we do."
"We don't do it. SIS makes a point of traveling only on British or Commonwealth passports."
"How sporting of them," Gabriel said.
"But it's far easier to travel the world on a British passport than it is on an Israeli one. Safer, too. Take a trip to Syria or Lebanon sometime on an Israeli passport. It's an experience you'll never forget."
"Smartass."
Seymour handed the passport to Gabriel.
"What were you doing in Amsterdam?"
"Some personal business."
"Elaborate, please."
"I'm afraid I can't."
"Did the Dutch know you were there?"
"Not exactly."
"I'll take that as a no."
"I always heard you were good, Graham."
Seymour pulled his face into a fatigued frown, a sign that he'd had enough of the verbal sparring match. The inhospitality of his reception came as little surprise to Gabriel. The British services did not care much for the office. They were Arabists by education, anti-Semites by breeding, and still resented the Jews for driving the empire out of Palestine.
"What have you got for me, Gabriel? I think an Al-Qaeda cell from Amsterdam might have entered Britain in the last 48 hours with the intention of carrying out a major attack."
"Just one cell?" Seymour quipped. "I'm sure they'll feel right at home."
"That bad, Graham?"
Seymour nodded his gray head.
"At last count, we were monitoring more than 200 networks and separate groupings of known terrorists. Half our Muslim youth profess admiration for Osama bin Laden, and we estimate that more than 100,000 supported the attacks on the London transport system, which means they have a very large pool of potential recruits from which to draw in the future. So you'll excuse me if I don't sound the alarm just because another cell of Muslim fanatics has decided to put ashore."
"Maybe it isn't just another cell, Graham. Maybe they're the real thing."
"They're all the real thing," Seymour said.
"You said you think they are here. Does that mean you're not sure?"
"I'm afraid so."
"So let me make sure I understand correctly. I have 16,000 known Islamic terrorists residing in my country, but I'm supposed to divert manpower and resources into finding a cell that you think might be in Britain?"
Greeted by silence, Graham Seymour answered his own question.
"If it were anyone but you, I'd pull over and let him out. But you do have something of a track record, don't you? What makes you think they might be here?"
Gabriel handed him the envelope of photographs.
"This is all you have? Some snapshots of Ahmed's holiday in London? No train tickets, no rental car receipts, no email intercepts, no visual or audio surveillance?"
"They were here on a surveillance mission 4 months ago. And his name isn't Ahmed, it's Samir."
"Samir what?"
"Samir al-Masri. Hudsonstraat, 37 Oud West, Amsterdam."
Seymour looked at the photo of Samir standing in front of the Houses of Parliament.
Is he Dutch?
Egyptian, as far as we know.
As far as you know? Well, what about the other members of this phantom cell? You have any names?
Gabriel handed him a slip of paper with the other names Ibrahim Fawaz had given him in Amsterdam. Based on what we know, the cell was operating out of the Al-Hisra Mosque on the Jan Hazenstraat in West Amsterdam.
And you're sure he's Egyptian?
That's the flag he was flying in Amsterdam. Why?
Because we've been picking up some chatter recently among some of our more radical Egyptian countrymen.
What sort of chatter?
Blowing up buildings, bringing down bridges and airplanes, killing a few thousand people on the underground. You know, the usual things people discuss over tea and biscuits.
Where's it coming from?
Seymour hesitated, then said,
Finsbury Park.
But of course.
There was perhaps no more appropriate symbol of Britain's current predicament than the North London Central Mosque, known commonly as the Finsbury Park Mosque. Built in 1990 with money donated by the King of Saudi Arabia, it was among the most radical in Europe. Richard Reed, the infamous shoe bomber, had passed through its doors. So had Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker, and Ahmed Ressam, the Algerian terrorist who was arrested shortly before the millennium for plotting to blow up Los Angeles International Airport. British police raided the mosque in January 2003. Inside, they discovered such sacred items as forged passports, chemical protective suits, and a stun gun. And eventually it was turned over to new leadership. It was later revealed that one member of the new board of trustees was a former Hamas terror mastermind from the West Bank. When the former terrorist gave the British government assurances that he was now a man of peace, he was permitted to remain in his post.
So, you think Samir is the cell leader?
That's what my source tells me.
Has your source ever been right in the past?
Do you remember that plot to shoot down an El Al jetliner at Schiphol last year?
The one that the Dutch broke up?
The Dutch didn't break it up, Graham.
We broke it up. With the help of this same source.
Seymour looked down at the photographs.
It's not much to go on, he said, but I'm afraid it does fit the profile of a major attack scenario we've developed.
What sort of scenario?
An action cell based abroad, working with surveillance and support cells buried within the local community here. The action cell members train and prepare in a place where we can't monitor them, then come ashore at the last minute, so we have no time to find them and disrupt their plans. Obviously, it would take complex planning and a skilled mastermind to pull it off.
He held up the snapshots.
Can I keep these?
They're yours.
I'll have immigration run the names and see if your boys have actually entered the country, and I'll give copies of the pictures to our colleagues in the anti-terrorist branch of Scotland Yard. If the Metropolitan Police deem the threat credible, they might put a few more men at some of the sites El Masri visited.
What about raising the overall threat level?
Gabriel asked. What about stepping up the surveillance of your local Egyptian radicals in Finsbury Park?
We're not like our American brethren. We don't like to move the needle on the threat meter each time we get nervous. We find it only serves to make the British public more cynical. As for our local Egyptians, we're watching them closely enough already.
I hope so.
How long are you planning to stay in London?
Just tonight.
Seymour handed him a business card. It had nothing on it but a telephone number.
It's for my mobile. Call me if you pick up anything else in Amsterdam.
Can I drop you at your hotel?
No thanks, Graham.
How about your safe flat?
Our embassy would be fine. I'm going to have a quiet word with our local chief of station and the head of embassy security to make sure we take appropriate measures.
Give my best to your station chief and tell him to behave himself.
Is it your intention to follow me after I leave the embassy?
I don't have the spare manpower, or I would.
He was lying, of course. Honor among spies went only so far.
Gabriel's meetings at the embassy ran longer than expected. The chief of security had turned what should have been a 5-minute briefing into an hour-long question-and-answer period, while the office's chief of station had used a routine courtesy call as an opportunity to try to impress the man he clearly assumed would one day be his boss. The debacle was made complete at 6, when the ambassador appeared without warning and insisted Gabriel accompany him to dinner in Knightsbridge. Gabriel had no excuse at the ready,
and was forced to endure a painfully boring evening discussing the intricacies of Israel's ties to the United Kingdom. Throughout the meal, he thought often of Eli Levon quietly reading files in snowy Amsterdam, and wished that he was still there with him. It was after 10 o'clock by the time he finally entered the office safe flat on the Bayswater Road overlooking Hyde Park. He left his bag in the entrance hall and quickly took stock of his surroundings. It was simply furnished, as most safe flats were, and rather large by London standards. Housekeeping had left food in the fridge and a 9mm Beretta in the pantry, along with a spare magazine and 2 boxes of ammunition. Gabriel loaded the gun and carried it with him into the bedroom. It had been 3 days since he'd had a proper night's sleep, and it had taken all his training and substantial powers of concentration to get through dinner with the ambassador without falling asleep over his coq au vin. He undressed quickly and climbed into bed, then switched on the television and turned the volume down very low, so that if there was an attack in the night, he would be awakened by the news bulletins. He wondered whether the Metropolitan Police had acted yet on the information he'd brought from Amsterdam. 200 active terror networks, 16,000 known terrorists, 3,000 men who had been through the training camps of Al-Qaeda. MI5 and the Met had more to worry about than 5 boys from Amsterdam. He'd sensed something in Graham Seymour's demeanor that afternoon, a resignation that it was only a matter of time before London was hit again. Gabriel was reaching for the light when he noticed Samir's yellow legal pad poking from the side flap of his overnight bag. Probably nothing there, he thought, but he knew himself well enough to realize that he would never be able to sleep unless he made certain. He found a pencil in the top drawer of the bedside table and spent the next 10 minutes rubbing it gently over the surface of the pad. Samir's secrets came slowly to life before his eyes. Pine trees on a mountaintop, sand dunes in a desert, a spider web of bisecting lines. Samir al-Masri, jihadist and bachelor slob, was a doodler. Chapter 8. Bayswater, London. 7:02 a.m. Friday. The telephone woke him. Like all phones in office safe flats, it had a flashing light to indicate incoming calls. This one was luminous blue. It was as if a squad car had driven into his bedroom on silent approach.
"Are you awake?"
asked Ari Shamron. "I am now."
"Sleeping in?"
Gabriel squinted at his wristwatch. "It's 7 in the morning.
"It's 9 here.
The vagaries of international time zones had always meant little to Shamron. He assumed every office employee, no matter his location on the planet, rose and slept in harmony with him. Inside the office, the phenomenon was known as Shamron Central Time.
"How did your meeting with Graham Seymour go?"
"Remind me never to use my Heinrich Kiever passport to enter Britain again."
"Did he act on the information you gave him?"
"He seems to have bigger headaches than a few boys from West Amsterdam."
"He does."
"We're going to have to bring the Dutch into the picture at some point."
"As soon as Eli has finished purging Rosner's archives, we'll summon the Dutch liaison officer in Tel Aviv and have a quiet word with him."
"Just make sure we protect our source. He's someone we need to slip in our back pocket for a rainy day."
"Don't worry. It will be a very quiet word."
"My plane arrives in Amsterdam in the early afternoon. If Eli and I work through the night, we should be finished by morning."
"I'm afraid Eli will have to finish the job without you. You're not going back to Amsterdam."
"Where am I going?"
"Home,"
said Shamron.
"Abodel will collect you in an hour and take you to Heathrow. And don't get off the plane looking like something the cat dragged in, the way you usually do. We're having dinner tonight at Kaplan Street."
Kaplan Street was the address of the Prime Minister's office. "Why are we having dinner there?"
"If it's all the same with you, I'd rather not discuss our highest affairs of state and intelligence while the eavesdroppers of MI5 and GCHQ are trying to listen in."
"It's a secure phone."
"There's no such thing,"
Shamron said.
"Just make sure you're on that plane. If you get stuck in traffic, call me from the car. I'll have El Al hold the plane for you."
"You wouldn't." The line went dead. Gabriel placed the receiver back in the cradle. "We're having dinner together tonight at Kaplan Street." He supposed he knew what the topic of conversation would be. Apparently,
Amos didn't have long to live. He looked at the television screen. Three telegenic young people were engaged in a deeply serious discussion about the sexual antics of Britain's most famous footballer. Gabriel groped for the remote control and instead found Samir's legal pad. Then he remembered waking in the middle of the night and gazing at the image, not the pine trees and the sand dunes, but the pattern of crisscrossing lines. He looked at it again now. Gabriel had been blessed with near-perfect visual recall, a skill enhanced by his study of art history and his work as a restorer. He had hundreds of thousands of paintings stored in the file rooms of his memory and could authenticate a work simply by examining a few brush strokes. He was convinced the lines were not random, but part of a pattern, and he was certain he had seen the pattern somewhere before. He went into the kitchen and made coffee, then carried his cup over to the window. It was beginning to get light, and the London morning rush was in full force. A woman who looked too much like his former wife was standing on the corner, waiting for the light to change. When it did, she crossed the Bayswater Road and disappeared into Hyde Park. Hyde Park. He looked at the notepad, then looked out the window again. Was it possible? He walked over to the desk and opened the top drawer. Inside was a London A to Z street atlas. He took it out and opened it to map number 82. It showed the northeast corner of Hyde Park and the surrounding streets of Mayfair, Marylebone, Bayswater, and St. John's Wood. The footpaths of the park were represented with dotted lines. Gabriel compared the pattern to Samir's markings on the legal pad. They matched perfectly. Hyde Park. But why would a terrorist want to attack a park? He thought of the pictures he'd found in Samir's flat. Samir in Trafalgar Square. Samir with a member of the Queen's Life Guard outside Buckingham Palace. Samir riding the Millennium Wheel. Samir outside the Houses of Parliament. Samir with four friends posing in front of the American Embassy in Grosvenor Square. He looked at the map in the London A to Z again. Grosvenor Square was two blocks east of the park in Mayfair. He picked up the telephone and dialed.
Graham Seymour.
I want to warn the Americans about the Amsterdam cell.
What Amsterdam cell?
Come on, Graham. There isn't time.
Immigration spent the night looking for them. So far, they've come up with no evidence to suggest any of the men whose names you gave me are even in the country.
That doesn't mean they're not here.
Why do you think they're going to go after the Americans?
Gabriel told him.
You want me to sound the alarm at Grosvenor Square because of some lines on a legal pad?
Yes.
I'm not going to do that. There's not enough evidence to support making a call like that. Besides, have you been to Grosvenor Square lately? It's an American fortress now. A terrorist can't get close to that building.
Call them, Graham. If you don't, I will.
Listen to me, Alon, and listen very carefully. If you make a mess of my town, so help me God, I'll...
Gabriel severed the connection and dialed another number. Chapter 9. Grosvenor Square, London, 7:13 a.m., Friday. The streets at the northern end of posh Mayfair have a distinctly American flavor. Tucked amid the stately Georgian buildings, one can find the headquarters of the American Chamber of Commerce, the American Club, the American Church, the American Society, and the Society of American Women. Along the northern side of Grosvenor Square is the U.S. Navy Building, and on the western side stands the American Embassy. 9 stories in height and adorned by a monstrous gilded eagle, it is one of the largest American diplomatic missions in the world and the only one to reside on land not owned by the federal government. The Duke of Westminster, who owns most of Mayfair, leases the property to the American government for the very reasonable sum of a single peppercorn a year. There is little danger the Americans will be evicted from their patch of Mayfair anytime soon, since the lease on the property does not expire until Christmas Day in the year 2953. 58 men and a single woman have served as the American ambassador to the court of St. James, including 5 who would become president, but only 1 has ever come from the ranks of the career foreign service. The rest have been political appointees and diplomatic debutantes, known more for their money and connections than their foreign policy expertise. Their names read like an honor roll of American high society and wealth. Mellon, Kennedy, Harriman, Aldrich, Bruce, Whitney, and Annenberg. The current American ambassador to the court of St. James, Robert Carlyle Halton, was not born to wealth, and few Americans knew his name, though he was by far the richest man to ever occupy the post, and his political connections were second to none. The president and CEO of the Denver-based Red Mountain Energy, Halton's personal fortune exceeded $5 billion at last estimate. He also happened to be a lifelong friend of the President of the United States and his largest political donor. The Washington Post, in a rather unflattering profile of Halton published shortly after his nomination, declared that he had pulled off the extraordinary political feat of putting his best friend in the White House. When asked about the accuracy of the report during his confirmation hearings, Halton said he only wished he had been able to give the president more money, a remark that had cost him several Democratic votes. Despite the fact Robert Halton was no longer responsible for a global energy empire, he remained an early riser and kept a rigorous daily schedule that was far more punishing than those of his predecessors. As usual that morning, he had left Winfield House, his official residence in Regent's Park, at the thoroughly undiplomatic hour of 6:45, and by 7 he was leafing through the London papers at his desk, overlooking Grosvenor Square. The pages were filled with dire news from Iraq. Halton was convinced the British, who had already made drastic cuts to their troop levels in Iraq, would soon be looking for the exits entirely, an assessment he'd given directly to the president during their last meeting at Halton's sprawling Owl Creek estate in Aspen. Halton hadn't minced words during the meeting. He rarely did. At 7:10, a tall young woman dressed in a cold weather tracksuit and fleece headband appeared in his doorway. She had long dark hair, pale green eyes set in an attractive face, and a trim athletic figure. Without waiting for permission to enter, she crossed the room and sat on the arm of Halton's chair. It was a gesture of obvious intimacy, one that might have raised eyebrows among the embassy staff, were it not for the fact that the attractive woman's name was Elizabeth Halton. She kissed the ambassador's cheek and smoothed his head of thick gray hair.
"Good morning, Daddy," she said. "Anything interesting in the papers?"
Robert Halton held up the Times.
"The mayor of London is angry at me again."
"What's eating Redken now?" Halton's relations with London's infamously left-wing mayor were frosty at best, hardly surprising, given the fact that the mayor had expressed compassion for the suicide bombers of Hamas and had once publicly embraced a Muslim Brotherhood leader who had called for the murder of Jews and other infidels.
"He says our security is causing major disruptions to the flow of traffic throughout Mayfair," Robert Halton said. "He wants us to pay a congestion tax. He's suggesting I pay for it out of my personal funds. He's quite sure I won't miss the money."
"You won't?"
"That's not the point."
"Shall I have a word with him?"
"I wouldn't inflict that on my worst enemy."
"I can be a charmer."
"He doesn't deserve you, darling."
Robert Halton smiled and stroked his daughter's cheek. The two had been nearly inseparable since the death of Halton's wife 5 years earlier in a private plane crash in northern Alaska. So inseparable, in fact, that Halton had refused to accept the president's offer to become his envoy to London, until first making certain Elizabeth would accompany him. While most young women would have leaped at the chance to live in London as the daughter of the American ambassador, Elizabeth had been reluctant to leave Colorado. She was one of the most highly regarded emergency room surgeons in Denver and was discussing marriage with a successful real estate developer. She had wavered for several weeks until one evening, while on duty at Denver's Rose Medical Center, she had received a call from the White House on her mobile phone.
"I need your father in London," the president had said. "What do I have to say to you to make that happen?"
Few people were better positioned to turn down a request from the commander-in-chief than Elizabeth Halton. She had known the president her entire life. She had skied with him in Aspen and hunted deer with him in Montana. She had been toasted by him on the day she graduated from medical school and comforted by him on the day her mother was buried. But she had not turned him down, of course, and upon her arrival in London, had thrown herself into the assignment with the same determination and skill with which she approached every other challenge in life. She ruled Winfield House with an iron hand and was nearly always on her father's arm at official events and important social affairs. She did volunteer work in London hospitals, especially those that served the poor immigrant communities, and was a skillful public advocate for American policy in Iraq and the broader war on terror. She was as popular with the London press as her father was loathed, despite the fact that the Guardian had published a little-known fact that Elizabeth, for reasons of security, had tried to keep secret. The President of the United States was her godfather.
"Why don't you skip the newspapers this morning and come out for a run with us?"
She patted his midsection. "You're starting to put on weight again."
"I'm having coffee with the Foreign Secretary at 9, and don't forget we're having drinks at Downing Street tonight."
"I won't forget."
Robert Halton folded his newspaper and looked at his daughter seriously.
"I want you and your friends to be careful out there. NCTC raised the threat level in Europe yesterday."
NCTC was the National Counterterrorism Center.
"Anything specific?"
"It was vague. Heightened activity among known Al-Qaeda cells, the usual crap. But that doesn't mean we should ignore it. Take a couple Marines with you for good measure."
"The Marines are only supposed to guard the embassy itself. If they start leaving the premises, Scotland Yard will throw a fit, and I'll be back on the treadmill in the gym."
"There's no law against American Marines running in Hyde Park. At least not yet. I suppose if Red Ken has his way, there will be soon."
He tossed the newspaper onto his desk.
"What's on your calendar for today?"
"A conference on African health care issues and afternoon tea at the Houses of Parliament."
"Still glad we came to London?"
"I wouldn't have traded it for the world."
She stood up and headed toward the door.
"Give my best to the Foreign Secretary."
"Don't forget, drinks at Downing Street."
"I won't forget."
Elizabeth left her father's office and rode the elevator down to the atrium. Four other people, attired as she was in cold-weather athletic suits, were already there. Jack Hammond, the embassy's public affairs officer, Alex Baker, an FBI special agent who served as legal affairs liaison, Paul Foreman from Consular, and Chris Petty from the State Department's Bureau of Diplomatic Security. Petty served as London's regional security officer, which meant he was responsible for the safety of the embassy and its staff. Two of Petty's assistant RSOs arrived a moment later. Their matching blue tracksuits did little to conceal the fact that they were powerfully built and well-armed.
"Where's Kevin?"
Elizabeth asked. Kevin Barnett, the CIA's deputy chief of station, rarely missed the morning run when he was in town.
"Stuck in his office," said Chris Petty.
"Anything to do with that NCTC alert?"
Petty smiled.
"How did you know about that?" "I'm the ambassador's daughter, Chris."
Alex Baker looked at his watch.
"Let's get rolling. I have a 9 o'clock at New Scotland Yard."
They headed outside and slipped through a gate in the north fence reserved for embassy personnel. A moment later, they were jogging west along Upper Brook Street, heading for Hyde Park. The Ford Transit panel van was painted forest green and bore a stencil on the side that read, "Addison and Hodge Limited, Royal Parks Contractors." The van did not belong to Addison and Hodge, but was a meticulously produced forgery, just like a second one already inside Hyde Park. As the group of Americans came trotting along Upper Brook Street, the man behind the wheel watched them calmly, then pressed a button on his mobile phone and brought it to his ear. The conversation he conducted was coded and brief. When it was over, he slipped the phone into the pocket of his coverall, also a forgery, and started the engine.
This is the end of disc number 2. Please continue listening on disc number 3.